Welcome to this latest episode of the podcast, The Sound of Solidarity. It's brought to you by the group Solidarity, a revolutionary socialist organisation based in Australia. And this episode is being recorded on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri people. My guest today is Koz Samaras. Koz is currently a director of the policy agency Redbridge and was previously for 14 years campaign director for the Victorian ALP. And Koz has been doing some research on the intersection between COVID and class, in particular for Melbourne. And I think around the world, we've seen that class has been a significant factor in the way people have experienced COVID and have suffered and died from COVID. One piece of research from the US pointed out that, for instance, 3,600 healthcare workers died in the US in the first year alone. Now, they were disproportionately the people who spent the longest time in the room with patients, which meant actually they were the lower paid and less prestigious roles in the healthcare system. And perhaps we're not surprised to find out that 2/3 of those deaths were amongst people of colour. So I'm talking to Koz today about what we can understand about the intersection of COVID and class in Australia, in Melbourne in particular, where we're both based. So hello, Koz.
G'day. Yeah, look, just in reference to that example you've cited in America, I first, before COVID reached our shores, I was watching closely the virus as it unraveled through countries like the US and Italy and so on. Because I've always had a view that disease and pandemics always hit the most vulnerable people without the economic wealth to escape disease and crisis. So I thought to myself when I first started seeing the news late January of last year, I'd better watch this closely because I think this is going to be a problem for things that I care about personally, and that is obviously people who don't have the economic wealth to protect themselves against global events of this nature. And so, quickly, when the evidence started emerging out of the US, basically stories around not just the health workers, but workers working for Amazon, for example, where they were being fouled by the dozens. And management refusing to set up any infectious control protocols, force them to turn up to work, threatening them with sacking or cutting of hours and shifts if they didn't turn up to work. And that was the first sign which alerted me to what would potentially happen here in Melbourne and this country if the disease got out. And sadly, in Melbourne it did. And sadly, we saw initially very similar challenges faced by people who you would best describe working in the precariat. So, you see, for example, when it first broke out here, the anecdotal stories we heard on the news where workers were working multiple sites, where people were being forced to turn up to work because the employer was demanding for them to be turning up to work. I think it was a factory out in the southeastern suburbs, Spotlight, I think it was, where the union had to actually step in to protect workers' health, because the employer was demanding their presence whilst refusing to provide sufficient protection. These sort of things occur all the time, as you well know. So it didn't take long for us to realise this city was not going to be any different to the rest of the world.
The reason I contacted you, Koz, was in particular I noticed a tweet thread you put up which highlighted the way in which poverty was distributed geographically in Melbourne, and your argument that the concentration of disadvantage of poverty amongst working class people in Melbourne lent itself to greater COVID problems and the risk of transmission. Can you take me through that argument?
Sure. Yeah, no problem. When you look at the way Melbourne's urban planning has unravelled over the last 20 plus years, and it has really been all about basically pushing the poorer individuals of our city out to the outer ring of the outer west, outer southwest, northwest, and the north. And mainly property has done that, but also work. When I was growing up here in Melbourne in the 70s and 80s, most working class people would work either in the inner city or they moved out to suburbs like Broadmeadows, because that's where I spent most of my life growing up. My parents moved out to Broadmeadows to work in factories like Ford and Yacca and Nabisco. So that basically, engineered a situation for this city where whether you're living out in Hoppers Crossing, Sunshine, St. Albans, Diggers Rest, Craigieburn, Epping, you're relatively living in suburbs that are very similar to each other. The people that live in those suburbs are economically relatively the same. Their social circles are relatively the same. If you look at where those individuals in those suburbs work, they don't actually go into the city for work. They largely drive across suburbs through the west and the northwest working, whether it's in retail, warehousing, and so on. What's happened there also is that you have an increase of what I call the precariat, actually guys standing, first term that label, which is, you know, the growing new class of the current industrial revolution we're all living through, which is the growth of the gig economy, as some people like to call it. I like to refer to it as the slave economy. Basically, jobs that have been created to basically service wealthier people in our large cities. So, Uber drivers, Uber Eats delivery drivers, people that clean people, clean hospital floors, and basically keep the lights on. So when a pandemic hits a city like ours, this workforce cannot work from home. It lives in very large numbers. About 1.2 million people in that stretch of sort of geography that I've just described live in that space. Once a virus is in there, the ability for people to isolate is limited. If you look at our aged care workforce, three quarters of it lives in that space, in that geography that I've just described. So it should not have come to any surprise that once the virus got into those suburbs, that getting it out would have been very difficult because, one, most of these people weren't working from home. They could not isolate. Two, for many of them, they work as casuals. Therefore, they are always living on the edge. Their relationship with their employer at times can be intimate, but also can be acrimonious. Their ability to adhere to public health directions is limited because, if you're sick, what you've done for the last 10, 20 years is actually turn up to work, because if you don't, then you get your hours cut. It's easier for someone in politics to say, if you're sick, stay home, get tested. Getting tested takes about an hour, if you live in the outer suburbs. Do you have an hour if you're spending 2 or 3 hours a day on the roads, getting to work, to and from work? You're working shifts that are irregular. You're working on multiple sites, just like aged care workers were. And you are in many instances working for bosses who don't have all that much compassion. So once a virus is in there, people are sick, they're not going to work from home, they're not going to isolate, they're going to turn up to work and they're going to spread the disease, and that's exactly what happened. And they're going to spread it right across the entire stretch of land from Werribee to Epping, right across that outer ring. And that's exactly what happened last year in our second wave.
In your Twitter thread, you actually draw a distinction between Melbourne and Sydney, because of course Sydney has, broadly speaking, as many poor working class suburbs, has as many people in those underpaid, low-paid, casual, insecure jobs. Why do you think there's a difference between Melbourne and Sydney? Because clearly last year we had a very different experience. Surely that can't just be put down to geography.
Yeah, so there's reasons behind that. Obviously one I think has got to do with public health and the way the public health response was wired in Victoria versus New South Wales. I think that New South Wales' system are far better set up, decentralised, more in tune with the needs of the local community than Victoria's was. I think Victoria's now is being retrofitted and it works quite well. So that's one layer. But if you look at Sydney, for example, you go to an area like Bankstown. Yes, you see disadvantage, but they almost the inner southwest part of Sydney is almost like an enclave of disadvantage. And then it stops because basically it's buffeted by areas of advantage and wealth. So poorer people tend to live and work a lot more localised than they do here in Melbourne. Here in Melbourne, a person working in aged care, for example, it would be not unusual for someone who lives in Craigieburn to be driving down to Werribee to work at an aged care centre. You won't see that in the same level in terms of intensity in Sydney. In Sydney, yes, they work in the same sectors, but they will avoid having to travel that amount of time because just traffic in Sydney is just a lot worse. You just could not get to work. Its road network kind of prevents that rapid spread across a very large stretch. And if you look at the LGAs of disadvantage in Sydney, they're not connected like one big giant corridor like Melbourne is. So, for example, you have Wyndham, Melton, Greenbank, Hume, Whittlesea, all interconnected. One big channel where people can basically commute and work and move through relatively unhindered. You don't see that in Sydney. The other layer, of course, is that, and we'll use Bankstown as an example, we've got to be mindful that, yes, you have people of significant disadvantage in Sydney and people who are employed in these really precarious occupations. But overall, Sydney's a wealthier city. To be able to afford a home in Bankstown, you'd be forking out $750,000 to $800,000. The median house price is around that. Those LGAs I've just now listed to you in Melbourne, no one living in those LGAs could afford living in Bankstown. They just wouldn't be able to buy anything there. So you find that, well, what's happened in Sydney is a lot of poorer people have actually been pushed completely out of the city, or have actually migrated to other states, and a lot of them actually come here in Melbourne. So it is not an accident, for example, that Melbourne is attracting more migrants from the Indian subcontinent. It's just cheaper to live here. It's cheaper to buy a house here. Therefore, it attracts a different type of person as well. All those factors mixed into one big cauldron tends to assist a virus spreading faster in a city like ours versus Sydney, where you do have areas of disconnect.
What would you say to the argument that working class people, especially frontline workers, it's not just health workers, it's also bus drivers, people working in fast food takeout places and so on, that they have suffered through the pandemic much, much worse than the middle and upper classes. It seems like a long, long time ago that we heard about people coming back from Aspen skiing holidays and bringing the virus with them. And yet they have also been the greatest victims financially and psychologically of the lockdowns. And I'm thinking particularly of quite draconian measures like the snap lockdown of the high-rise units, Kensington and North Melbourne. Do you think that's a fair argument? Were people there treated decently?
It's a difficult one. So when you talk about the towers, and again, going back to that observation a lot of us were making at the beginning of the pandemic, where we were watching in New York the virus get into large housing estates and just ripping through them. I think the fatality rate in one of the housing towers in New York was 20%. Because, you know, you're dealing with people who are obviously, you have a lot of working people in those towers, but you also have a lot of people who are suffering significant underlying health conditions. My criticism there would be that governments around the world, Western governments around the world, left and right, have ignored the living conditions of people in these towers. You know, I've got a view that these towers need to be brought down and well-constructed, ventilated public housing needs to be built to accommodate these people rather than housing them in these constructions that have been sitting there for 60 years. So really, I think the decisions that were made were unavoidable, but also a consequence of neglect, multi-generational neglect. When it comes to lockdowns, yes, again, the poor suffer the most. They still are. They are right now in Melbourne. But the flip side is, and I use this analogy quite a lot to describe the problem that working class people are facing globally, but are facing during this pandemic. Last year, the aged care workers that were infected, that were forced to turn up to work by their unscrupulous employers in the private sector, were working multiple sites. They were largely young migrant women from newly arrived communities, turning up infected with COVID, infecting the old migrants who came to this country in the 50s and 60s and who worked in factories and could only afford a retirement aged care facility of that nature. When their time of need came, they could not afford a very expensive catered facility. So they ended up in what we call the cheap version, which of course lacks everything from the way these people are treated to food to infectious control protocols. And we've got to be mindful, even before the pandemic, thousands of people died in these aged care homes from simple things like the flu unnecessarily because of poor infectious control protocols in these facilities and society just turned a blind eye to. So kind of I hope that answers your question. I think it's really the pandemic. I use this analogy. The pandemic is like a bucket of dye. It's poured over a rough surface and we can see all of society's imperfections nice and clear. That's what it's done.
On that note, I suppose my last question is broader. To those in academia and around the place who argue that class is an outdated concept, I don't agree. Solidarity doesn't agree. We're socialists, we're Marxists, but
yep.
You've talked about the reality of working class experience in Australia. What would you say is the importance of understanding how Australia is divided by class?
Well, we've seen the consequences of it. This pandemic has shone a strong light on the living standards and the plight of working people in this country. And what we're seeing right now is an attempt to obscure that. The reason I put that tweet up was more about there was this comparison about, well, there's no difference between Sydney and Melbourne. And yes, that statement alone, when it comes to demographics, is indeed correct. But I get pretty annoyed when people try to avoid talking about class and this disease and pandemics and the plight of working people, full stop. It's always an attempt by parts of the media, academia, and politicians to not talk about it, because talking about it for many is a realisation that they have to admit that they are party to a system that has now been set up to subjugate people into an existence that is not good. I go back to that, you know, what I call the slave economy, which is a society in Western society, a society that's been built to service or middle class, upper middle class professionals. Someone's going to drive you somewhere. Someone's going to deliver you food. Someone can do your laundry. Someone can pretty much take care of everything when it comes to your needs. Someone can serve you. Someone's going to wipe your floors. Now, you say that's always been around, but I think that's actually been, you know, that's now become an extension. So it's now basically you can pretty much live your life as a highly qualified professional and work from home and not be exposed to disease, because someone else is going to go and pick up the shopping for you. Someone else is going to deliver the parcel for you. You can cocoon yourself from danger because someone else is going to be exposed, and that someone else is the working person. That's the point I'm trying to make, and that is that governments have turned a blind eye to this. You could just say rejoiced, even in parts of the media, will rejoice in the growth of the gig economy, not turning their attention to the fact that, you know, someone's got to work three sites just to earn a reasonable income to break ins meet at the end of the week. And suddenly everyone realised last year, hang on, there's this young woman, she's got to work three sites just to earn a 4 week's pay. How's that happen? They weren't even aware of it. Yeah, I don't think there's a solution, unfortunately, because I think that the systems that have been set up, there isn't the will, the political will to change it, and you could see it now. So, you know, we experienced what we experienced here in Melbourne last year. There was a realisation that a particular workforce was exposed to this disease. There was the acknowledgement that was a problem, and the Victorian government introduced, you know, some form of pandemic leave. The federal government didn't. Then you had the period over summer where things were quite good, and we've now got this breakout. And again, we're back to the same rhetoric. We're not talking about, well, hang on a minute, the reason why the disease is spreading through Melbourne again is because it's going through the same communities again for the same reasons.
And the federal government having brought in supposedly measures to prevent people working across multiple private aged care providers, quietly dropped that measure in November, and it turns out actually handed out very little money indeed in the first place.
Correct. The first thing they do to appease their mates in the industry is to remove the one thing that was creating not only misery for the workers, but also exposing what I call working class, vulnerable elderly people. We're going to remember that the people in these aged care homes, mostly elderly, frail people who once used to build our cars, make things in factories, produce our food. These people are the ones that died last year. Like I grew up in a working class manufacturing Greek family, so my parents worked in factories all their life. And their generation was the generation last year that died. You know, 130 of them in the Greek community died from COVID. Did anyone talk about the ethnic class dimension of that? That's why you'll find that, you know, I'm always going to try to bring some attention to it, because it's always missing from the narrative.
All right, Cos, I know you're a busy man, so I will thank you very much for your time today.
Great, thank you.
My second guest today is Chris Breen. Chris is a teacher at a high school in Broadmeadows. He's an activist in the Australian Education Union, including being a state councillor, and he's a member of Solidarity. And it's really useful to talk about Broadmeadows. Cos has talked about Broadie as the place he grew up. It's one of the areas which is hardest hit by the levels of poverty and casualisation. So what I wanted to do today was ask Chris, first of all, what has it been like for workers and their families in Broadmeadows, both you and your colleagues as teachers, but also the families of the kids that you're teaching?
thanks for having me on. COVID has had a huge impact on the Broadmeadows region. In the last big COVID outbreak, Broadmeadows was one of the suburbs that was locked down while everybody else wasn't, because it had one of the highest COVID rates. Being a economically disadvantaged area, the lockdown has a disproportionate impact. You know, already there's huge levels of unemployment in Broadmeadows. And last time I looked, I think it was sort of 15 to 20%, which is just incredible. Since you've had the shutting of Ford and other things like that, and because of the disadvantage, things like lockdown have a disproportionate impact. And so you can see that on some of my students. Like, we're back in online learning. It's certainly not all students, but there's enough students. They'll be in the Zoom meetings, and when they unmute themselves to speak, you'll hear, other kids in the background, TVs, other things. They don't have a quiet place, a space to go and work. Taking one or two examples, there's time around, not this time, I had a student who was a very good student, and you could sort of see him deteriorate over time. During the long period of online learning, being in a two-bedroom house with six people and a disabled sibling and that sort of difficult circumstances. I've had other students who've been effectively looking after their own siblings during the lockdown. The government, which calls the lockdown, provides no support for this. I mean, the one thing I will say that's interesting, in the last lockdown, our school did manage to make sure that every student had a laptop and connection to the internet. And it's something that we had a bring your own device policy for a long period of time. Students had to pay for laptops. They always said it couldn't be done, and then suddenly they did. And I think that's something that they should continue as part of the usual school life when we're back in class.
Obviously, you don't talk to your students in class about their family lives. That would be intrusive. But do you have a sense of how many of them have parents who have lost jobs or lost hours? And any sense of how that's coming through for the kids in terms of stress and psychological damage?
It's very hard to measure, because it's not something that the students talk about. They won't. Like, there's a, it's not a public thing. There's degrees of shame attached to that. And there's, there's already so much disadvantage. But I mean, I guess the one way of measuring these things is we have such needy students. They, in terms of attention, we get welfare updates in staff meetings. And there are students who come into class and they can be right pains. And we will be told by, welfare, just there is really difficult things going on in their home life. And when they come into class, they're not starting from zero. They're already elevated at, 70 because of everything that's going on. We need to be as nice and calm. But it's difficult when you've got, so many students in difficult situations in the same class.
You mentioned the Ford factory closing. That was some years ago now. And clearly there's been a retreat in manufacturing, but manufacturing hasn't disappeared. And there are many jobs which are not the gig economy. Coz, quite correctly, in his earlier comments, talked about the way in which working class people, particularly poorer working class people, are suffering hardest with the pandemic. He also talked about the working class as a precariat. Is that the way you would describe it?
No, I don't think there is a precariat as such. I think there has been an ongoing attack on the working class. I think, the working class is something like 70% of the population, people whose choice in life is to work for a wage or be unemployed. And that includes, Uber drivers, that includes cleaners, that includes teachers like me. And there's been an attack which has seen more and more casualisations and precarity amongst workers, but I wouldn't call it a precariat. So, for instance, when you talk about manufacturing, I mean, there was a toxic fire at a factory in Broadmeadows last year. It came all over our school. We had to get evacuated. And, some of the people injured in that were refugees, people on bridging visas. they were casually employed, but these were full-time jobs. It's, you know, something I've faced in my own employment history, working full-time jobs for casual rates of pay. And the working class is still able to organise and to, you know, to resist and fight back under such circumstances. I mean, a whole range of different ways. Like in a small way, at our school, we were, last lockdown, we were going to be made to come in to teach from school, even though we had no students at school. And, you know, teachers organised. We had a union meeting of 70 and stopped that. In my own history, I remember being employed at the land titles office, and there were 200 of us working on a project for 2 years. We were all casual. We still managed to have a four-hour strike and win a $10 an hour wage rise. So even in such circumstances, people are still able to organise. So I think the precariat is mislabeled, although I do think it's true that casualisation, unemployment, these things do bite. You know, there's no doubt about that. So, I mean, casualisation is everywhere, even in teaching. I think it's around 10% of the workforce. You know, teachers are a strong union, and it's something that our union, I think, needs to fight and could put an end to.
The theme of this episode is the way in which the pandemic affects working class people differently and worse. We're recording this episode in week two of the Melbourne lockdown, the fourth lockdown. Now, Solidarity has argued for more than a year that lockdowns are a sign of public health failure, a sign that there are too few contact tracers, too few resources, too few ways in which people can be safely isolated and supported and given financial backing while they're in isolation. It seems to me, a year on, that many of those problems, at least at state level, have now been fixed, that public health, belatedly in Victoria, is much, much better than it was, with a much bigger team of workers, regionalised contact tracing. More than 5% of the Victorian population has been tested since the beginning of this outbreak. We've had a peak of 57,000 tests on one day, with the overwhelming majority of those test results coming back within a day, or at least within 36 hours. Under those circumstances, it seems to me that this lockdown is unnecessary, that the public health system, at long last, is capable of dealing with small-scale outbreaks. What's your take on this?
There's been some improvements, I mean, certainly to contact tracing and testing. I mean, even in Victoria, the ability to name the sites that are at risk. But I think you want to be a little bit careful about how much things have improved. I mean, if we look at the start of this lockdown, it's once again a leak from a quarantine hotel. So some of the lessons, it seems, have still been learned. There have been 21 leaks now. There's been a proposal to build a purpose-built quarantine facility by the Victorian government, which is a good proposal. I mean, that's something that should have happened already. Again, we're seeing cases go into aged care. Still, we're seeing people move between aged care homes. Still, we're seeing casualisation, with people faced between going to work, whether or not they've got symptoms, and not getting paid or losing shifts. I mean, you know, it's a crime that the Morrison government has absolutely failed on the vaccination in aged care homes. And if you look at some of the reports from aged care bosses, they were telling staff they didn't want them to get vaccinated because they were worried about them taking the next day off when they get a reaction. Having said that, I do still think this lockdown is perhaps a panic and an overreaction. The contact tracing and testing does seem to have improved. I suspect that the Victorian government was nervous that some of the improvements are quite new and they're still a bit underconfident about it. I suspect they've made a political judgment as well that short, sharp lockdown, even if it's overkill, would be better politically than for them than something that gets out of hand, and they just don't have the confidence in their own systems yet that it will. I do still think that lockdowns should be a measure of last resort rather than a first. So the improvements in contact tracing and testing are very good. There also needs to be purpose-built quarantine facilities. There needs to be an end to casualisation and pandemic leave for all. I mean, still, we've got teachers who are, you know, casual relief teachers who just lose income completely during this lockdown period. And the vaccine rollout needs to be stepped up as well.
Okay, thanks for your time today. Let's hope the lockdown is lifted very soon and we're back on the streets and on the picket lines.
So do I. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.